She was a peasant girl, then the leader of an army, then a captive, then a heretic. Today on Wings, the conclusion of Carolyn Gage's drama, The Second Coming of Joan of Arc.
There's a river of birds in migration, a nation of women with wings. There's
Welcome to Wings, a series of news and current affairs programs by and about women around the world, produced and distributed by the Women's International News Gathering Service.
So they take me out of my cell. They take me to a cemetery, and they built these two platforms specially for the occasion. And this one here is for me, and that one over there is for the judges, and way over there is the cart with the executioner waiting to take me to the public square where the stake is. And I want you to imagine for a minute, all around you, all over this room, a sea of faces, ignorant, vicious faces. Faces of people who have come specifically to watch you die. Faces that expect it. No, they insist on it. Faces that should be familiar to you. Working class faces. Faces of older women like your grandmother. Faces of little girls like your sister. Human faces. And all of them are completely unrecognizable. I mean, there is not one glimmer of compassion, not one spark of sympathy. They are looking at you, but they don't see you. They see their long-awaited revenge. They see their promised entertainment. They see their reward for living cowardly and conservative lives. The world owes them your death, and they're going to get it. Now, I had been in battle many times, and I had expected to die many times. I had even tried to kill myself. But there was nothing in my experience to prepare me for these hideous faces. Fear is one thing, but this was horror. So, while they were reading my sentence, I broke down and confessed. I denied my voices. I promised to wear a dress. Now, what happens when we women finally do break, which is usually after almost superhuman suffering? Do we win a reprieve? Are we released, forgiven? Does the torture stop? Does the pressure let up? I have known all kinds of women to give in all kinds of ways. To guilt, to harassment, to sex, to drugs, to alcohol, to mental illness. And in every single instance, listen to me, the abuse increases. There is no mercy for women because our crime is our gender. We have got to fight. So, I confessed. And like most women, I expected some reward for selling myself out, for betraying my voices, for denying my purpose, for surrendering every scrap of my integrity. I expected that I would be moved to a church prison where there would be other women prisoners and women attendants. But this didn't happen. They took me back to my little cell, back to my five guards. Only now, I was wearing a dress. Meanwhile, the crowd with the faces was starting to get ugly. They didn't know anything about heretics or laws or procedures or confessions. All they knew was that they wanted to see somebody suffering more than they were. And when they realized they'd been cheated out of an execution, they were ready to riot. So you see, the political pressure was starting to build to find some way to make me break the terms of my penance. Now that was Thursday when I signed the confession. On Saturday, one of the guards opened the door to my cell, and he let an Englishman in. He was well-dressed. I thought he must be a lord or something. I stood up to see what he wanted. Jean? Yes? Wham! the maiden. Wham! And I'm on the floor, and he's kicking me in the stomach and the ribs. I roll into a ball, and he's kicking my back and my legs. And then suddenly, he's on the floor over me, and he's pulling up my dress with one hand. Now, if I had been wearing men's clothes, he would have had to use both hands. He would have had to untie 40 knots and 2 sets of lacings with both hands. I would have made him pay for it, you better believe it. But with a dress, one hand, one movement, that's what dresses are about, isn't it? Accessibility. I don't see where that's changed much in 500 years, and neither has rape. And I'm lying on the floor, and he's smacking my face back and forth. Wham! Wham! And with his other hand, he's taking out his... And here's my precious girl body. My own sweet body. My body. Me. My sweet body. And he's wham, wham, wham. And I can't focus my eyes, and my nose is bleeding, and he's talking to me between his teeth in some language I don't understand. And then suddenly he stands up and he kicks me again in the uterus and the back. And then he's gone. And the guards are standing there, and I think, they're going to rape me too. But they didn't. See, it's like a cat playing with a crippled bird, pouncing on it and shaking it while it struggles to get away. And then as soon as the bird dies, the cat just drops it and walks off. The game's over. Well, there I was, raped, battered, broken. The game was over. After 5 months, it was finally over. Well, I mean, the guards stood around for a while, hoping I'd show some sign of the old spirit. But I didn't. So they just walked off. That was Saturday. On Sunday, I woke up to feel one of the guards pulling my dress off. He threw my old clothes on the bed and told me I could put those on or go naked. Now, you have to understand, it was against the terms of my penance ever to wear men's clothes again. I begged him to give me the dress, but he wouldn't. They just laughed at me and waited. Now, I stayed in bed pleading with them until noon. But I had to get up and pee, so finally I put on my old clothes again, my so-called men's clothes. And as soon as I did that, the guards went to tell Cochon, and he and the others came scurrying like rats to see for themselves. And then the miracle happened. I had been raped and battered and broken. I had denied my voices. For 3 days, I had not known who I was. And then suddenly I put on my real clothes, and I came back to myself. I knew who I was again, and I was all through with compromise. Nobody mentioned my swollen and bruised face, and I didn't mention it either. I said I was wearing men's clothes of my own free will. I looked right at those guards, and I said nobody had made me wear them. I said, as long as I have to live in a man's world, I'll dress like a man. If they'd send me to a decent prison where I could be with other women, I'd wear anything they liked. And then they asked me if I had heard the voices of St. Catherine and St. Margaret since Thursday when I signed the confession. And I said, yes, as a matter of fact, I have. And my voices told me that in trying to save myself, I had condemned myself. And my voices told me that every single thing that I had ever done in my entire life, I had done well, and that it was a lie to say anything different. Well, of course, the notaries are all writing this down as fast as they can, and when I get to that last part, they write, fatal answer, in the margin. That was Sunday. That was the day that I rose again from the dead. Rape is the crucifixion of women, and I am proof that there is life after rape. Even more life. Because when a woman is raped, she buries that part of herself that's accessible to men. Now, in a rape culture, they'll try and make you believe that's everything, but it's not. She rises again with what no man can penetrate, her self-esteem. She is reborn in her own image. Wednesday, they came to get me. I no longer had to measure myself against the world. I was my own person. And I cried uncontrollably. They gave me communion, and then they took me out to the cart. And this priest who used to try and spy on me in my cell, he climbed into the cart and tried to get me to forgive him. They pulled him out and told him he better leave town if he knew it was good for him. There were 100 English soldiers escorting me to the public square where the stake was. This time they put the platforms in the same place as the stakes. I guess they didn't want to risk another confession. They put a hat on my head, a hat with names, idolater, heretic. There was a sign on the platform where I stood, Jean, liar, seducer. Somebody gave a long sermon. I wasn't listening. I didn't even notice the faces that had bothered me so much the week before. Now, they hadn't changed, but I had. I had been raped. They read my sentence. I remember they called me a dog returning to my vomit. I prayed. People were laughing. They excommunicated me. And then they turned me over to the bailiff. And two men shoved me over to the platform where the stake was and threw me up on it. The stake was very high so that everyone could see it. Usually the executioner kills the victim so they don't actually have to burn to death. But in my case, the stake was so high, he couldn't reach me to do the job. I had a little wooden cross under my clothes against my breast. And this priest sent to one of the churches on the square for a ceremonial cross, and he held it up so I could look at it. And then they tied me to the stake, and they lit the fire. Between the time they lit the fire and the time I lost consciousness was a long time. It was a long time to wonder where God was. My voices were with me because they're a part of me, but where was this loving Father with all the power to save people, or at least to make me die quickly? Do you remember when Dorothy exposed the Wizard of Oz? And you hear this booming voice, pay no attention to the man behind the curtain. Well, let me tell you, when we women begin to expose the actions of men, we hear this voice urging us to protect and forgive. And this voice is so ancient, so powerful, so authoritative, that we're overcome with guilt and shame, even though we're the victims. Now, I'm here tonight to tell you something about that voice telling you to protect and forgive men, that voice urging you to be a little more patient, a little more tolerant. That is not the voice of God, that is the voice of the men behind the curtain. And the only reason that it sounds like the voice of God is because they have been amplifying themselves for 2,000 years and using special effects. Tied to the stake and watching the fire come closer and closer, I realized that God the Father was a lie. I realized he was an invention of the good old boys to cover their tracks and to cover their asses. I realized the closest that I had ever been to any real sense of spirituality was alone with my voices or in the company of other women. I realized what a fool I had been to crown some man king as if he had a divine right to rule. I realized what a fool I had been for trusting a church run by men who only worship themselves. I realized what a fool I had been to lead one army of men out against another as if it could make any possible difference which side won. And I realized what a fool I had been for believing I would be saved from the actions of men by a God they had created in their own image. God the Father was a lie then and is a lie now, and all of the hierarchies modeled after him are illegitimate. The government, the armies, the churches, the corporations, the families. We will not convert them. They will martyr us. We will not convert them. We have got to fight for our causes, women's causes. We have got to clothe ourselves in our self-esteem, arm ourselves with our finely tempered rage, and listen to only those voices that we women can hear. So, Saint Joan of Arc. 20 years later, they had a trial to rehabilitate me. That's because I was holding my own as a national hero, and if there's one thing the Catholic Church can't stand, it's competition. Besides, the myth of the feminine, simple-minded peasant girl had begun to replace the memory of the cross-dressing butch with a smart mouth. Well, the second trial was pretty much a formality without the star witness. Everybody pretty much knew ahead of time how things would turn out. Not too much interesting, except one thing. My best friend, Oviette, she testified. I didn't even think she'd remember me. I remembered her. Oviette and I had been very, very close until the year I ran away. We had grown up together. We had taken our first communion together, which was a very special thing. You see, it was a custom in my village for the girls who shared their first communion to sleep with each other. She'd come over to my house, or I'd go over to hers, and we'd sleep in the same bed together. And sometimes we would pretend that the bed was a very small boat on the ocean and that I had rescued her from drowning. And I would hold her in my arms, and my heart would be so filled with tenderness that I would feel lightheaded. Or she'd pretend that she'd found me wounded in the forest and had taken me to her cottage, and she would bandage my wounds and cover me with kisses. Oviette and I, we were more than best friends. We were one soul. We knew this, and we had always planned to live together when we grew up. But like I said, there was this terrible thing, puberty. Oviette got engaged. I wouldn't even speak to her. How could she do this to me after I had gone to so much trouble to break my own engagement? So I left Domremy. I left and I didn't tell her I was going. I said goodbye to all my other friends, not to her. So here she is, 20 years later, testifying. And what does she say? She says she cried her eyes out when she heard I left Domremy. She said she loved me because I was so good. And then she called me her lover. She's 40 years old, married, standing in a room full of Catholic priests and judges. And she says this about a girl who's been dead for 20 years. A girl who left her without saying goodbye. Oviette. She had a lot more courage than I did. See, it was easier for me to face the English army, the French Inquisition, even the executioner, than to face her and to say, I love you. There is one crime I committed. It's one they overlooked in my trial. It's the one for which I suffered the most, for which I suffer every day. I confess it. I denied my love for a woman. And I denied the woman who loved me. So you see, there was no Saint Joan of Arc with this legacy of glorious martyrdom. But there was a Jean Rome who made the terrible, terrible mistake of trying to find a substitute in the world of men for the love that she'd experienced in the arms of a woman.
So, Carolyn Gage, I've seen commentary about your play, The Second Coming of Joan of Arc, on a Joan of Arc website, and there was a fellow there who claimed to have translated some of the documents, and he disagreed very strongly with your interpretation that Joan was lesbian, that she was anorexic, and that she was sexually molested or abused or threatened in her family. I wondered what you would say to him if we had him on the show right now.
Well, first off, let me say that I'm not a scholar going into these Latin archives. Well, I read everything about her that was in print and in circulation in libraries. But my primary source was Vita Sackville West's book, and she wrote one of the first biographies after all of these records were translated into contemporary French, which I think was in the 1920s. So for the first time, lay people who weren't scholars with access to Vatican archives had access to these reams of trial transcripts. And Vita, of course, cross-dressing was an enormous part of her coming into her lesbian identity. And I think she chose Joan of Arc because she was fascinated by a woman who would rather die than wear a dress. And she's focusing a lot on the personal details that she could glean. I don't know how accurate her research was. It's very footnoted, but subsequent scholars always build on and dismiss the work of previous scholars. So I'm not surprised that the Sackville West biography has fallen into some form of scholarly disrepute, because we've had 70 or 80 years of research after that. But as I'm remembering, it was in part of the transcripts that her father had a dream that he saw her leaving town with a group of soldiers. His interpretation of that was that she was headed for a life of prostitution. And he shared that with her. Now, we don't know if that was a polite conversation or it was an angry drunken one. The record seems to support that the father was quite a drinker. It was noted that he was in the pubs and so on when he went with her to the crowning of the king. I mean, I am kind of working backwards for my story, which is the lesbian butch survivor. And that is so hidden from history. We have to piece it together backwards. What would make a 17-year-old suddenly adopt a male persona and ride off to crown a king? And, you know, Sackville West's biography indicates that there was a beloved girlfriend that she slept with and that was documented. And that at the point where this girlfriend became engaged to Mary, that was when Joan, well, kind of signed up for the army, which is not unlike what a lot of my peers did in high school when their hearts got broken. They went into the military. That's a place where, you know, women go to find an identity other than a housewife. So I'm not claiming to write a docudrama, but I don't think the simple-minded peasant girl struck dumb with visions from God. That doesn't wash for me. When I look at the record of her trajectory, everything in it is pretty consistent with a deeply disturbed adolescent survivor with a transgender identity or a lesbian butch identity. So that's my story, and I'm sticking to it.
So you've based this on the work of Vita Sackville West. Do you think that she had a similar experience of Joan's identity and relating it to her own identity?
I absolutely do. And anybody who questions that, I draw you to her introduction to the book, where she says something like the secret of Joan's identity was yet to be articulated. She's using kind of coy euphemisms.
So your play is called The Second Coming of Joan of Arc. And the Vita Sackville West book, if people want to look that up, is called?
I believe it's just called St. Joan of Arc.
And are there any other references that you'd like to call attention to your audience?
Leslie Feinberg wrote a book, Transgender Warriors, several years back, and I believe she devoted a chapter to Joan and not only talked about the transgender aspects of Joan's history, but her working-class identity and proud affiliation with that. And certainly somebody from the peasantry or working class person rising that fast in the ranks and crowning the king and standing next to him and would evoke an enormous backlash of antagonism from members of the elite class. I really appreciated that.
Wow. How many times have you performed this play?
Oh, boy. I would say probably getting close to 100 now, maybe, or something. I retired the piece for about 5 years because I had such terrible emotional problems with it. I needed to take a break and do a lot of personal recovery. The story was a little too close to home for me. And in my play, Joan is, she's got the politic right, but she hasn't figured out how to form effective alliances with women, and she hasn't really figured out how to love herself yet. But she knows how to fight. And she knows she's claiming her anger against men. And it's a very scary place when you come to consciousness about patriarchy, but you haven't uploaded the skills for building an alternative to it yet. Then you're just kind of left with massive betrayal and banging your head against a brick wall. That's understandable for a 19-year-old who was, through her betrayals, coming to consciousness and making those connections so rapidly. But it is a tragedy, ultimately, and I felt like I needed to go and prove to myself that I had learned some of the things that Joan didn't, which I should, as I lived twice as long as she did. And then I could go back and pick it up and perform it again without being so devastated by it.
So have you written another play that you would consider the progress play from this?
Well, it's funny, like all of the work around the time of Joan of Arc, and I had a theater company called No to Men, and I was really... you know, just dealing with the shock of my own betrayals coming to consciousness. But somewhere after writing Joan, I started becoming much, much more interested in what women do to other women than what men do to women. I began to feel like the real front is women's inability to form these effective alliances and an internalized oppression, the internalized roles, the lack of empowering archetypes like the butch, warrior, etc. And so my work, really the focus shifted not on, oh my gosh, look what the men are doing to us, but like, whoa, let's talk about what we're doing to each other. And that's a huge shift in focus. And I'd say that's really been the in-depth inquiry of the last decade of my writing. And particularly what women do to survivors, recovered and unrecovered. That's of great interest to me.
Any final comments?
I'm just thrilled that you're broadcasting this, and I encourage anybody to contact me through my website, carolengage.com. You can get to my email. I'd love to hear from any of your listeners about this play. And I guess I should say one of the pieces of history of this play, which you know has about a 15-year history now, is that many of the women who hear it make radical changes in their lives. They will write to me that they have left their husband or walked out of their job or confronted their perpetrator. So I always enjoy the feedback from the play and the effect it's had on women's lives.
Author and actor Carolyn Gage. That's CarolynGage, carolyngage.com. Special thanks to Suzette Cullen and to Genevieve Vaughn, editor of Il Dono, The Gift. The Wing sound logo is from Libana's album A Circle is Cast. I'm Frieda Worden, and this is Wings, the Women's International News Gathering Service.